Part 2 Chapter 12 Clive had suffered little from bewilderment as a boy. His sincere mind, with its keen sense of right and wrong, had brought him the belief that he was damned instead. Deeply religious, with a living desire to reach God and to please him, he found himself crossed at an early age by this other desire, obviously from Sodom. He had no doubt as to what it was. His emotion, more compact than Morris's, was not split into the brutal and the ideal, nor did he waste years in bridging the gulf. He had in him the impulse that destroyed the city of the plain. It should not ever become carnal, but why had he, out of all Christians, been punished with it? At first he thought God must be trying him, and if he did not blaspheme would recompense him like Job. He therefore bowed his head, fasted, and kept away from anyone whom he found himself inclined to like. His 16th year was ceaseless torture. He told no one, and finally broke down and had to be removed from school. During the convalescence, he found himself falling in love with a cousin who walked by his bath chair, a young married man. It was hopeless. He was damned. These terrors had visited Morris, but dimly. To Clive, they were definite, continuous, and not more insistent at the Eucharist than elsewhere. He never mistook them. In spite of the rain, he kept on grossness. He could control the body. It was the tainted soul that mocked his prayers. The boy had always been a scholar, awake to the printed word, and the horrors the Bible evoked for him were to be laid by Plato. Never could he forget his emotion at first reading the Phaedrus. He saw there his malady described exquisitely, calmly, as a passion which we can direct, like any other, towards good or bad. Here was no invitation to license. He could not believe his good fortune at first, thought there must be some misunderstanding, and that he and Plato were thinking of different things. Then he saw that the temperate pagan really did comprehend him, and, slipping past the Bible rather than opposing it, was offering a new guide for life. To make the most of what I have, not to crush it down, not vainly to wish that it was something else, but to cultivate it in such ways as will not vex either God or man. He was obliged, however, to throw over Christianity. Those who base their conduct upon what they are, rather than upon what they ought to be, always must throw it over in the end. And besides, between Clive's temperament and that religion, there is a secular feud. No clear-headed man can combine them. The temperament, to quote the legal formula, is not to be mentioned among Christians, and a legend tells that all who shared it died on the morning of the Nativity. Clive regretted this. He came of a family of lawyers and squires, good and able men for the most part, and he did not wish to depart from their tradition. He wished Christianity would compromise with him a little and search the scriptures for support. There was David and Jonathan. There was even the disciple that Jesus loved, but the church's interpretation was against him. He could not find any rest for his soul in her without crippling it, and withdrew higher into the classics yearly. By 18 he was unusually mature, and so well under control that he could allow himself to be friendly with anyone who attracted him. Harmony had succeeded asceticism. At Cambridge he cultivated tender emotions for other undergraduates, and his life, hitherto grey, became slightly tinged with delicate hues. Cautious and sane, he advanced, nor was there anything petty in his caution. He was ready to go further, should he consider it right. In his second year he met Risley, himself, that way. Clive did not return the confidence which was given rather freely, nor did he like Risley and his set, but he was stimulated. He was glad to know that there were more of his sort about, and their frankness braced him into telling his mother about his agnosticism. It was all he could tell her. Mrs. Durham, a worldly woman, made little protest. It was at Christmas the trouble came. Being the only gentry in the parish, the Durhams communicated separately, and to have the whole village looking on while she and her daughters knelt without Clive in the middle of that long footstool cut her with shame and stung her into anger. They quarrelled. He saw her for what she really was, withered, unsympathetic, empty, and in his disillusion found himself thinking vividly of Hall. Hall. He was only one of several men whom he rather liked. True, he, also, had a mother and two sisters, but Clive was too level-headed to pretend that this was the only bond between them. He must like Hall more than he realized, must be a little in love with him, and as soon as they met he had a rush of emotion that carried him into intimacy. The man was bourgeois, unfinished and stupid, the worst of confidants. Yet he told about his home troubles, touched out of all proportion by his dismissal of Chapman. When Hall started teasing, he was charmed. Others held off, regarding him as sedate, and he liked being thrown about by a powerful and handsome boy. It was delightful, too, when Hall stroked his hair. The faces of the two people in the room would fade. He leant back till his cheek brushed the flannel of the trousers and felt the warmth strike through. He was under no illusion on these occasions. He knew what kind of pleasure he was receiving, and received it honestly, certain that it brought no harm to either of them. Hall was a man who only liked women. One could tell that at a glance. Towards the end of the term, he noticed that Hall had acquired a peculiar and beautiful expression. It came only now and then, was subtle and lay far down. He noticed it first when they were squabbling about theology. It was affectionate, kindly, and to that extent a natural expression, but there was mixed in it something that he had not observed in the man. A touch of impudence? He was not sure, but he liked it. It recurred when they met suddenly or had been silent. It beckoned to him across intellect, saying, "This is all very well. You're clever, we know, but come." It haunted him so that he watched for it while his brain and tongue were busy, and when it came, he felt himself replying, "I'll come. I didn't know." "You can't help yourself now. You must come." "I don't want to help myself." "Come, then." He did come. He flung down all the barriers, not at once, for he did not live in a house that can be destroyed in a day. All that term, and through letters afterwards, he made the path clear. Once certain that Hall loved him, he unloosed his own love. Hitherto it had been a dalliance, a passing pleasure for body and mind. How he despised that now. Love was harmonious, immense. He poured into it the dignity as well as the richness of his being, and indeed in that well-tempered soul the two were one. There was nothing humble about Clive. He knew his own worth, and when he had expected to go through life without love, he had blamed circumstances rather than himself. Hall, though attractive and beautiful, had not condescended. They would meet on an equality next term. But books meant so much for him, he forgot that they were a bewilderment to others. Had he trusted the body, there would have been no disaster, but by linking their love to the past, he linked it to the present, and roused in his friend's mind the conventions and the fear of the law. He realized nothing of this. What Hall said, he must mean. Otherwise, why should he say it? Hall loathed him, had said so. "Oh, rot!" The words hurt more than any abuse, and rang in his ears for days. Hall was the healthy, normal Englishman who had never had a glimmer of what was up. Great was the pain, great the mortification, but worse followed. So deeply had Clive become one with the beloved that he began to loathe himself. His whole philosophy of life broke down, and the sense of sin was reborn in its ruins and crawled along corridors. Hall had said he was a criminal, and must know. He was damned. He dare never be friends with a young man again, for fear of corrupting him. Had he not lost Hall his faith in Christianity and attempted his purity besides? During those 3 weeks, Clive altered immensely, and was beyond the reach of argument when Hall, good, blundering creature, came to his room to comfort him, tried this and that without success, and vanished in a gust of temper. "Oh, go to hell! It's all you're fit for!" Never a truer word, but hard to accept from the beloved. Clive's defeat increased. His life had been blown to pieces, and he felt no inward strength to rebuild it and clear out evil. His conclusion was, "Ridiculous boy. I never loved him. I only had an image I made up in my polluted mind, and may God help me to get rid of it." But it was this image that visited his sleep and caused him to whisper its name. "Morris. Clive." "Hall," he gasped, fully awake. Warmth was upon him. "Morris! Morris! Morris! Oh, Morris!" "I know. Morris, I love you. Are you?" They kissed, scarcely wishing it. Then Morris vanished as he had come through the window.